Hey, this is Thomas Q. Jones, former UVA All-American running back, and you're listening to The Jerry Ratcliffe Show. Wahoo wah.
Welcome to the podcast. I am Chris Graham, and I'm joined by Jerry Ratcliffe here on The Jerry Ratcliffe Show. And before we forget, Jerry, you got a great new sponsor, and let's thank the new sponsor and kind of get them welcome to the family with the show here.
Absolutely, Chris. A lot of people will remember John Copper, who played linebacker for Virginia and Fort Kenyon Military Academy. And for my old high school coach, Jim Hickam, down at Northside High School in Roanoke. But John now works with Greenberry's Coffee, headquartered in Charlottesville. And they have come on board as our sponsor for the website and the podcast. We're very grateful to them. We'll be doing a commercial for them soon, and their ad, please check out their ad on our website. I've been reading it, Chris. My mind was blown. I've been going to Greenberry's down Barracks Road for years. I had no idea that they were also in Harrisonburg, McLean, Virginia, D.C., two or three places in D.C., they are now in Japan. They are now in Saudi Arabia and expanding. And I think they're on the stock market now, so people can invest in Greenberry's. That's how great a company they are. So thankful for them to be on board. And we're working on some special promotions that we'll be notifying our listeners and readers to here in the near future. So, you know, go in and have a cup and tell them Hootie sent you.
Greenberry's, thank you for Greenberry's joining on. And, you know, when you mentioned John Copper, Jerry, I had to say, I didn't realize, you know, I remember the name and I thought he was more recent than when I look it up here. 2008 is when he graduated from UVA. And that dates me a little bit now. I was thinking it was just not a couple years ago, but like 3 or 4 or 5 years ago or something like that. Yeah, John is a 2008 alum. He had, I got here, 301 career tackles, 9.5 sacks. Doesn't seem like that long ago, John. I'm sure it doesn't seem like that long ago to you either.
Well, we were having a coffee at Greenberry's recently, and he told me a great story that when he was had just come on board at UVA, and I think he was a walk-on initially and earned a scholarship, rightfully so, because he was a rugged, never stop, never quit kind of guy. And he was struggling with some things, and he saw that Chris Slade was in town. I guess Chris was still in the NFL at that point. And he went over and was kind of, you know, hesitant, I guess, a little bit, but he asked Chris if he could talk to him. And Chris ended up spending like an entire day breaking down film with him and showing, giving him tips and helping him. And it's something I know that John will be forever grateful for. And it just shows you what kind of guy Chris Slade is too.
It does. It does. And now we got him on staff. We talked with Chris a couple of weeks ago on the podcast here, and he hit the ground running. He'll be coaching defensive ends for us this year. And he's got some more defensive ends. You know, Jerry, I know we're going to talk UVA Duke here, but we ought to talk about a couple of those defensive ends. Is that okay to work in real quick?
Oh, absolutely.
Since we mentioned Chris, it just popped up in my head here that you had a couple of really nice stories about and well-read stories, let's point out as well, about some two guys that Virginia picked up, a Stanford pass rusher and then a big recruit from Miami of Ohio. Both these guys had some looks from some big name schools, offers from big name schools out of the transfer portal, and these were two coups for Coach Tony Elliott and John Rusinski, the defensive coordinator, to land on the defensive line two defensive ends who can really get to the quarterback.
Yeah, Cam Butler, the kid from Miami of Ohio, is I'll tell you, he was a high commodity in that transfer portal. He entered in late January, and he was immediately pounced upon by a lot of really good football schools, including Penn State, where I think most people probably figured he would end up going. Also, Iowa, Kansas State, West Virginia, Ole Miss, and some others. He was a first team All MAC defensive end, 6'3", 250 pounds. He's the kind of guy you want to add to your front seven who can really make a difference. And his coach at Miami just raved about him and said he has a high motor, never quits. There was one game, I think, against Akron where he dominated, and he said every time I looked up, he was either sacking a quarterback or chasing a quarterback. He said they just couldn't block him. So that's exactly the kind of guy Virginia needs in this defense, is somebody who can put some pressure on the quarterback, because they didn't do that very well last year, Chris, as you know. And, you know, he was second team All-MAC in 2020, the COVID season, and also second team All-MAC in when he started 14 games as a sophomore, I guess, in 2019. You know, he's a pass rush machine, it seems like. You know, he was a three-star edge rusher coming out of high school. So I think he's going to be a weapon, along with the kid that they already had from Michigan State, who's a defensive end and has a lot of experience. And then the other guy they got this just the other day is Andres Fox, 6'4", 245, grad transfer out of Stanford. He's got 2 years of eligibility remaining. I think Butler may just have one. I need to check on that.
I think that's right too. He played all four seasons there at Miami, so I think he would just have the one.
That's what I was thinking. But Fox has two, and he hasn't played in a lot of games. He played in six games with one start last season. I don't know if he was injury plagued or not, but in the year before he played six games. When Stanford only played six games because of COVID. But the intriguing thing about him, I think, Chris, is that when he was in high school down in Mobile, Alabama, he was rated the 14th best defensive end in the country by ESPN and the 138th best recruit in the country overall by ESPN and the number six recruit in the state of Alabama. And usually those guys work out pretty well. I don't know if he's had injury problems or what might have been the problem, but his last 2 years in high school, he had 31 sacks and 88 tackles, 28 for loss. So it sounds like there might be some untapped potential there. And I know he was considering Maryland and Florida State along with some other people before he settled on Virginia. So I think Tony Elliott and John Rudzinski have given Chris Slade something to work with.
Looking for a great dining experience in Charlottesville? Look no further than the Aberdeen Barn. The Barn has been family owned and operated since 1965, with Terry and Angela providing great atmosphere and mouth-watering food at Virginia's big-time steakhouse. Enjoy the fine dining or relax in the Sportsman's Bar, a fantastic place to wind down and socialize, surrounded by flat-screen televisions tuned to the latest sporting events. You never know who you might bump into at the Aberdeen Barn, where all the greatest Cavaliers have dined over the decades and keep coming back for the delicious menu and good times. Check it out online at aberdeenbarn.com or call 434-296-4630.
Yeah, defensive end was a position of need, big time need, after the end of the last season. You bring in those two guys, you bring in Paul Aker, also the Columbia grad transfer. You mentioned Michigan State grad transfer, Jack Camper. All of a sudden, you've got a two deep there.
Yeah, how about that?
So whether they go 3-4 or 4-3, you need two ends. And you got four guys there that can add in. You got, you know, of course, on the interior, you got Aaron Faumui, Jameer Carter, Ben Smiley, Agunloy coming back, Bryce Carter, a four-star recruit from the class of 2021, Michael Diatta, another recruit from class of 2021. So defensive line goes from a position of need to a position of strength, I think, for this Virginia football program.
It would seem so. And The one thing about getting these four grad transfers, as you well know, and our listeners well know, is it might not be great for high school kids, but, you know, all these guys have played college football. They know the rigors. They know the routines. They know what the demands. And they all come from, you know, pretty good programs and pretty good academic institutions as well. So they should fit right in smoothly, I would think. All they got to do is just learn the terminology or the new scheme, and they're going to hit the ground running, I think.
Yeah, generally speaking, your high school recruits have to not only learn a lot of, you know, they haven't played at the college level yet, they have to get in the weight program, the weightlifting program, the training and conditioning. They got to go to the training table a little bit, eat right. And so, yeah, these guys have been through all that. They've been through the wars as well. So, big stuff for Virginia football, getting closer to spring practice, but still working the transfer portal, our Tony Elliott and the staff. All right, Virginia Duke. We're recording this on Tuesday, so if you're listening on Wednesday, when we say tomorrow night, that's what we're talking about. But Virginia won the first matchup. Virginia fans who are listening know this already, 69-68 down at Duke. But, Jerry, you know, the more I looked at the stats, even that night, but especially since that night and had a chance to digest those stats, the thing that surprised me the most was that the game was as close as it was. Virginia really, I mean, dominated the paint. You know, they held the big guys in check. There's four guys who are looked at, the four freshmen for Duke are looked at as one and dones. Three of them are lottery pick potentials. Trevor Keels may be just outside the lottery. Even the sophomore center, Mark Williams, is looked at as a second round pick for this team. It's a talented Duke team. But Virginia, in my opinion, thoroughly outplayed Duke down there. Had to win with a three-pointer with 1.1 seconds to go from Reese Beekman. But Virginia really played well. And, you know, that's in a tough environment. They come back home tomorrow night.
Yeah. Orange out, right?
Big orange out. That's right. If you're listening, wear orange.
It'll be interesting to see JPJ in all orange like that. I don't know if we've seen that before. But
I don't know that we have either. I think it may have been a white out once, but I don't remember an orange out anytime recently anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, in recent history, Duke and Virginia has been one of the closest series, not only in the ACC, but anywhere, I guess, but among really good basketball teams. All these games seem to be settled by 5 points or less, no matter where they play.
Here's a stat, Jerry, we posted to both of our websites today. Six of the last eight games, 1 or 2 points.
That doesn't get any closer than that.
The average margin of victory in the last 13, and I don't know how many games back that goes, but the average margin of victory in the last 13 is 4.3 points. So, yeah, this has been a heck of a series.
Yeah, better than the Carolina-Duke series, really.
Yeah.
So, two great programs going head-to-head. I was surprised that Virginia was able to pull that upset at Cameron just because it rarely happens. That was only the third time since 1995. Counting 1995, I believe, with Junior Burrow and Corey and all those guys. So it's a rarity, and it's one of the toughest places to play in the country, obviously. And it's because they're always good. And they have a Hall of Fame basketball coach, the winningest coach of all time. We asked Krzyzewski about that on the teleconference this week, and somebody mentioned, it might have been Mike Barber, I'm not sure. Somebody asked him about the series and why it's been so close, and about Duke being, you know, cemented as maybe the top program in the country, really, over those years. I don't know, but he said, well, Virginia is, Krzyzewski was complimentary. He said, well, Virginia is not just an emerging program. They are firmly planted as one of the best programs in the country. That's pretty high cotton. Great compliment from somebody like Krzyzewski. And he said, and you've got one of the best coaches in the country in Tony Bennett. And he says, we both had high caliber players, so these games should be highly competitive, which they have been. But I'm with you. What amazed me was that Virginia was able to dominate the paint at Cameron and score 52 points in the paint against all those talented big guys that Duke has. And they're not giants by any means. They're pretty darn good post players. And 52-28, Chris. I don't know if Virginia's dominated the paint like that against any other program that they've played this year. Like, to that extent, 52-28, that's mind-blowing.
You know, and Krzyzewski pointed out after the game that Virginia's first 22 points were in the paint. Then he went zone. And Virginia scored 32 points in a paint against the zone. So, you know, either way he went that night, Virginia seemed to have the answer. And that's even more stark. I mean, those talented guys who are going to four or five of whom are going to be playing the NBA next year couldn't keep these Virginia kids out of the lane no matter what Coach K tried to do.
Yeah. And, you know, the fact that Caden Shedrick has just come on like gangbusters the past 3 or 4 weeks. He's starting to get it. I mean, he's been a force. Not only – he went 8 for 8 shooting that night, but he also had multiple rebounds. He had some blocked shots, altered some other shots. He and Poppy Cafaro have just been really good in tandem. They haven't played that much together, but just coming in and out for each other. And then Jaden Gardner, the way he shut down Banchero was somewhat of a shock to everyone, I think. And Krzyzewski mentioned, he said, well, Gardner is an experienced player. He's a good player. He knows how to play at this level. And he said, I think he's having an ACC caliber year. And I would tend to agree with that. Gardner has been everything we thought he would be. He had a couple of games where he kind of dropped off the radar, but for the most part. Good and had multiple 20-point games in recent past.
Yeah, I've got him, let's see, past 8 games, I've got him averaging 18.5 points, 7.9 rebounds, shooting 51.2% from the floor, 24 of 25. He's 27 of his last 28 overall from the foul line, but 24 of his last 25 in the last 8 games.
I think he had made 31 straight free throws until he missed the other night against Miami.
Yes, exactly. So that's not something you expect from a big guy, but he's a great free throw shooter. You know, so a couple other sets of numbers. Banchero had the off night against Gardner the first time, 9 points and 9 rebounds. In his last five, that wasn't the only off night he's had. His last five, he's only averaging 11.7 points a game. This kid started the season as the prohibitive choice to be the number one pick in the draft coming out, you know, in 2022. And, so he's 11.7 points, 7.3 rebounds a game, shooting 46% from the floor and 3 of 17 from 3 in his last 5. I don't know what that says. You know, Gardner played good against him, a good defense against him particularly. Virginia post-to-post doubled him a little bit and a lot in that first half. But second half, he just kind of floated around the perimeter, didn't do anything. And then you talked about Shedrick, and I got some numbers on Shedrick too. I'm wondering who gets to start tomorrow night because Kafaro's playing well too, but Shedrick, he had that huge night, 16 points, 8 of 8 shooting against Duke. In his last, 10.2 points in his last 6 games, 10.2 points per game, 7.1 rebounds per game, shooting 72% from the floor. That's a great 1-2 punch there. If one guy gets in foul trouble, the other guy can step in. Kafaro has done really well lately as well. So, Virginia's 4 and 5 spots looking pretty good. And Banchero has been a little bit of a mystery lately. It's why he's not playing better than he has been. Jerry, we seem to have an issue.
Yeah, those numbers you recited about Shedrick, are those? Are we okay now?
Yeah, we're okay now. Yeah. Just a second. We had a blip with you there. So,
yeah. I don't know what blipped out, but I was saying the Shedrick numbers are reminiscent of Jay Huff, but Banchero is a bit of a mystery. Although I do recall Seth Greenberg, our buddy, mentioning during that game, and maybe even after in some post-game analysis, that Banchero I wouldn't say the word is soft, but that he's kind of shied away from some of the physicality, and he compared him to somebody else from Duke from a few years back. I can't remember who it was, but
I think he said Jabari Parker.
I believe you're right. I believe it was Jabari.
Another Parker. Kid who was a one and done, who came to Duke with great expectations, and you know, was, I think he was the third pick in the draft, and really hasn't done much in the NBA since, unfortunately for him.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's an issue or not, but anyway, I'm sure Gardner will be matched up with him again Wednesday night, and it's going to be interesting to watch and see how that matchup goes throughout the night, because that's going to be one of the keys to the game, I believe.
UVA Orthopedics and Sports Medicine boasts one of the finest teams of doctors in the country, and they're right here in Charlottesville to not only provide care for the University of Virginia athletic teams, but also the Charlottesville and Central Virginia communities. UVA Orthopedics has been a proud sponsor of the Jerry Ratcliffe Show for the past 2 years, with numerous team members featured in weekly segments where doctors share great insight into various sports injuries, what causes them, how to treat them, and recovery time. Their team of experts are there for you and offer the best care to solve your health problems and get you back on your feet. Let their team of specialists get you back in the game.
This is Chris Slade, former University of Virginia defensive end, graduate of 1993, back on the staff at UVA. Excited to be back coaching my old stomping grounds. You're listening to the Jerry Ratcliffe Show.
I went back, Jerry, to my pregame breakdown of the first game before the February 7th game. And the thing that concerned me the most was that Duke's guards are, again, all three of their guys, the 1, 2, and 3 positions, are projected first round picks in the upcoming draft. Two of them are lottery projections, and they're all big. Trevor Keels is 6'4", 221. He looks like a running back. Wendell Carter is 6'5". He's also got experience as a junior. And then AJ Griffin is 6'6". And Virginia's got good defensive guards. Got Reese Beekman, who's the best defender in the ACC. A lot of folks say that. We agree with that. Armon Franklin, talking about his health might be a question, but he's a really good defensive guard. And Kia Clark is a good defensive guard. He's just 5'9", and he's got to guard one of those guys who are 7 or 8 inches taller than him and a lot heftier. I was worried about that. And then you look at the stats after the game, and Virginia's guards outplayed Duke's guards in that one. That surprised me more than anything about that first game.
Yeah, well, Beekman is so hard to get around, and even if you do get around him, he's liable to pick your pocket from behind.
As he did in the last 2 minutes of that game, a very key play.
Yep, and so he's solid. Armon is a good defensive player. He's really knows how to slide, and he's quick. We have to worry a little bit about his health, like you said. Something that Tony kind of described is sort of like turf toe.
That's not good to hear.
it didn't seem to be as severe as maybe some that we've experienced in talking to our good friends from UVA Ortho over the years about how bad it can make you miss a whole season.
Yeah.
But I don't think this one is in that range. I think it must be a different caliber of toe injury. But hopefully that won't slow him down in his ability to defend. And then Kihei, yeah, we all know he's a warrior. He doesn't back down from anything or anybody. And, there is a size difference there. But, you know, sometimes I've noticed over the years, I've heard coaches talk about it, sometimes you can put a small guy on a bigger guy. And because that guy has such a lower center of gravity and balance and everything, he can get up in your grill. And that's what Kihei specializes in. And we all remember the story from his freshman year when he was bothering Ty Jerome so much in practice, getting up in his grill, that Ty just started screaming and threw the ball at Kihei as hard as he could. So yeah. That's a badge of honor if there ever was one. And so, he might be smaller, but he's a really good on-ball defender. So, if those guys are playing at their highest level, it could be another long night for the Duke guards. But you're right, though. It's going to be hard to shut those guys down over the length of the game because they're good. They're really good.
And Virginia did this in the first one with Reese Beekman in foul trouble the whole night. He had two fouls, had to leave early in the first half. Ended up with four fouls. He only played 25 minutes, a season low until the next game. He ended up playing 23 in the next win. Virginia had to get some minutes, big minutes, from a walk-on. And we talked about Malachi Poindexter a good bit on the last couple of podcasts, but boy, his 14 minutes in that game, I think he had one shot from the field, just a minus four plus minus. That means that Duke outscored Virginia by 4 points when he was on the floor. But for a walk-on who scored 13 points a game at St. Anne's Belfield a couple of years ago, he got some key minutes and did well enough with Reese Beekman on the bench with foul trouble to help keep Virginia in that ball game.
Yeah, well, you know, he's worked hard and he's earned Tony's trust to come in and give Kihei and Reese a spell if they need a breather or if either one of them gets in foul trouble. Kihei rarely does, but the guy, he understands the pack line and he's efficient in it. And, he doesn't have to really score. He just needs to play defense and not turn the ball over. And I think as long as he does that, he's fine in there for however many minutes that Tony deems necessary.
Wanted to sing the praises really quick of Cody Statman, averaging 3.2 points in 14.4 minutes per game this season. But there have been some games, and Miami was one of them, with Franklin on the sidelines. First with foul trouble, Armand went to the bench 17-minute mark or so, maybe 18-minute mark of the second half with his third foul. Statman came in and didn't leave. He played, I think it was 18-minute mark. It was exactly 18:00 on the clock now that I think about it. He came in and didn't leave. He played so well. He scored 8 points in the second half, made all three of his shots, one of them a three, and ended up with 27 minutes, a season high for Cody in that one. And, so Cody doesn't get the consistent big minutes every night, but in a pinch, he can also do some damage for you. And he's a veteran guy. He's been around for 4 years, and he's a very efficient guy. He won't make too many mistakes and can actually surprisingly play some really good defense for you as well.
Yeah, and, they desperately needed one of those guys 6 through 8 to come on like that. The opportunity's been there begging for somebody to step forward, and it's nice to see him put in some good minutes. And, as you mentioned, against Miami with Armand in foul trouble a little bit and having the toe injury, Tony put Statman in and they played the final 18 minutes of the game with no substitutions, which is rare, really rare.
Very rare, yeah.
And it's a lot about trust, and he trusted those guys. They performed. They took it to Miami. I wrote about it. You probably did too, that Jim Larrañaga, 3 minutes into the second half, knew that Virginia was coming, and he knew that there wasn't much he was going to be able to do about it. He called a timeout, and he told him, he said, if you don't buckle up, they're going to hand it to you. And he was exactly right. Virginia did. And the fact that Tony trusted that lineup for 18 minutes and played Shedrick with four fouls for a lot of those minutes, it was just amazing that they were able to dominate the second half the way they did.
That's a good Miami team that they dominated. And that Miami team had a 10-point lead the start of the second half after an early turnover by Virginia. And yeah, that's kind of reminded me a little bit of the end of the Louisville game on the road last year when Tony went to the bench. He played an uncharacteristic lineup. I think that game he took Jay Huff and Sam Hauser out of the game and put some guys in. And Tony's gut instincts are interesting. He's pretty good at figuring out what is needed on a game by game basis. And he doesn't just go by a formula. Hey, it's the 10-minute mark of the second half, I should bring this guy in. He really goes by feel, and his feel is often right on.
Yeah, man, he knows some basketball, I'm telling you. It was mentioning them being down 10 points in that game to Miami. It was interesting watching Twitterverse. A lot of my followers were panicking big time, and they had given up on the game, given up on the season, given up on everything pretty much. And it's so amazing how these guys can come back in the second half and just turn a game completely around. And a lot of it's just a lot of it, I think, too, Chris, and it's not just Tony's knowledge, but at halftime and in those huddles, I wish we could listen sometimes, particularly into the huddles, because he challenges these guys. I mean, he really gets to them somehow. He just gets to their innermost gut and challenges them that you can't quit. Keep playing hard. You can do this. We don't know exactly what he says, but, man, I'd love to be a fly on the wall or in the huddle to listen to some of those inspirational things he's passing on to his players and challenging them to get the job done and leave it all out on the floor. And they listen.
And this year there are a number of guys who will get votes for ACC Coach of the Year, and Tony probably won't get any votes. Because Virginia was picked, I think, fourth in the preseason, and they're right around that mark now. Steve Forbes doing a great job at Wake Forest. Mike Bray's doing a great job at Notre Dame. Larinaga, of course, in Miami, with all the struggles they've had. Yeah, I mean, those are three guys. They'll split the votes. Tony Bennett, we overestimated what we thought they had coming in, and the loss to Navy in the opener open up the eyes. They lose at JMU, a team that's not even in 500 in the CAA right now. To come back, I mean, the team that lost at JMU to now be 17-10, 11-6 in the ACC, two wins over Miami, one win over Duke, getting ready to play them again. At worst, you're going to be 3-1 against those two really good teams. This is a great coaching job. He's won a championship. That's a pretty good coaching job too, but this rivals what he did in 2018, 2019 in terms of getting the maximum out of a team. He has gotten the maximum. He might even be 110% of what he could get out of his team in terms of what he from what you've seen in progress from the Navy loss, the JMU loss to where they are now. It's beyond what you could expect from a coach.
Absolutely. And I think I have my ears straight. I think Barry Parkhill, who I have incredible respect for basketball, I think he said last year might have been Tony's best coaching job because they didn't have the talent that they had had in the previous few years. They had some of it, but they had issues. That team had issues. And for him to get them to where they made the NCAA tournament was pretty darn good job. But I would say that this year's job more than rivals that. I think he's had less to work with. As Seth Greenberg told us the other day on our podcast, Chris, he said they had pros making those shots before. Well, yeah, they don't have any pros.
Last year's team was so challenged, had three guys who played in the NBA this year.
Yeah. So he doesn't have that this year. And like you said, to come back from where they were with the two transfers that have just now starting to settle in and understand the pack line and blend in. And be outstanding. And then Shedrick, who had not played hardly at all. Poppy, who has progressed. And Beekman, who is starting to come into his own. Still like to steal more offense from him. But his defensive credentials are impeccable. And then, whatever he can get off the bench, which hasn't been a lot. So, man, if people did vote for him for Coach of the Year, they wouldn't be wrong.
No. So let's, for our listeners, as we're maybe getting ready to wrap up, let's break down the stakes for this game. They're obvious. If you're listening to this podcast 30 minutes in or so, you know what the stakes are. Virginia at 17-10, 11-6 in the ACC. A lot of years, 11-6 in the ACC, a win at Duke, two wins over a Miami team that's pretty much a lock to get in the tournament would be enough. You could lose this one. You can win your last couple and you could punch your ticket, but this isn't the typical year for the ACC. It's a down year for the ACC. After Duke, which is projected as a two seed, your next best seed is probably Carolina, maybe some combination of Carolina, Miami, Notre Dame, Wake Forest. And the best of them is going to be a nine seed, most likely, from what we're seeing right now. So Virginia still needs an impressive win. And this is their last chance outside of going to the ACC tournament and making a run at an impressive win. Duke kind of has something to play for too. If you know, we've been in their place where you're either a 2 seed or a 3 seed or maybe a 1 seed if you get hot. That doesn't really mean much when it really counts, because at the end of the day, you're just playing for seeding. But they want to get a win too. They want to just avenge that loss in Durham a couple weeks ago. So both teams come in wanting a win. Virginia probably wants it more. But Virginia definitely needs it more. I don't know that this guarantees anything, but a win here really puts Virginia on the right side of the bubble, I think.
Yeah, I agree. They're 3-5 in quad one, and to be 4-5 and having won 3 of those on the road, I think speaks volumes. I don't understand. I'm not completely sure about the net. It seems to have some flaws to me, but because I've seen some other teams with a lot shakier records than this that are ranked much higher.
Virginia Tech, for example? Yeah.
Yeah, that's one. I think Minnesota or somebody was one of them. Michigan State, maybe.
Michigan will be another. There's quite a few.
Yeah. And Virginia's, Virginia, as soon as they beat Miami, they were number 80. And the next day, they fell to 81 without even doing anything.
Yeah.
Made no sense to me. But, I don't see how you can ignore a team that at this point, if they beat Duke, would have 18 wins and 2 wins over the best team in the conference and 2 wins over Miami, who's I wouldn't want to play Miami in the NCAA tournament if I was somebody. And then a win over on the road over Providence, who's pretty darn good. But, Virginia's number 73 in KenPom, which is a little better. The scary thing about the net is that no team ranked above 73 has ever made the NCAA tournament. So if Virginia wins out in the regular season, it'll be interesting to see if they can move inside that number 73 line from 81.
Great. Update, Jerry, 82 now.
82?
82. Everybody else is holding. Wake and Virginia Tech and Carolina, 40, 41, and 42 have not changed since Saturday night. Virginia's gone from 80 to 82. Wow. This net thing must have been designed by somebody who got a master's degree or a PhD from Virginia Tech is all I can think.
Well, Ken Palm is. He's
a healthy boy. And we went from 74 to 76 a day after the win at Miami in Ken Palm. Yeah. Went up to 74, then went back to 76. So, yeah.
Through the years, Virginia's had 3 ADs serve on the men's basketball committee, not only as just a selection committee member, but as chairman at some point. And I remember Holland and Dick Schultz and Little Page all telling me that usually committee members put a lot of stock on how a team is finishing. It's particularly if it's a team that had injuries early in the season or a lot of new players or some kind of obstacle to overcome. And if they put it together the last month of the season or 5 weeks and are hot and playing well and playing to their potential, I don't know if this net takes that into consideration. I hope the committee still does.
You see team sheets. I found online an NCAA tournament team sheet for Baylor last year. And one of the things you see that doesn't get included in net that you can see publicly, at least, is your record in your last 10 games. Now, of course, right now, 10 games for Virginia would be 7-3. But they obviously won 5 of the last 6. And with 3 more to go in the regular season. So, yeah, if you're in that stage, Virginia would be a hot team. Virginia Tech would probably be a hot team. They lost their last most recent game, but still, they'd won 5 straight or 6 straight going into that one. So, yeah, they do. Because they always say that what they want is, they're seeding teams who can win a championship. And if you're 2-8 in your last 10, you're not playing good basketball. It doesn't matter if you're – we saw a Virginia team back in Pete Gillen's time that was number 3 in the country at one point and finished off, I want to say 2-8 maybe down the stretch. Went to the NIT, even with good computer rankings, and primitive though they were at that time. You want a hot team because a hot team is playing its best basketball. Maybe they have a chance to win some games and get and win a championship. So Virginia's got hot at the right time, just got to keep it going. And you know, I'm seeing some doubts out there from some folks. You know, you talk about Twitterverse, you know, that even if Virginia wins out, they may have to make a run in Brooklyn. I think if you beat Duke and you hold serve and holding serve, you know, beating Florida State, beating Louisville on the road, that's tough, but still you're going to be favored going into that one. If you go 3-0 down the stretch here, it's going to be hard to keep this Virginia team out, I think.
Yeah, because what's that, 19 or 20 wins?
That'd be 20 wins, yeah.
It'd be 20 wins. So, you know, 20 and playing hot.
Yeah.
Like you said, five of the last six, that would be
eight of the nine, right?
So how can you get any hotter than that?
Even if you lose your first one to Brooklyn, now that's not advised, but you'd be eight out of 10. And so, yeah, I mean, they're playing good basketball at the right time. I still, honestly, Jerry, I think you play well against Duke, satisfy the computers in that respect, win the last two, win one, and I think three more wins total. However they happen, I think three more wins total. 20 is not the magic number. I just think it's three wins against, you know, ACC teams. Will boost their rankings up. It'll make them, you know, hot, like you pointed out there. I think 20 could be a magic number in a sense, just because of where Virginia is now. But that said, Duke is an opportunity. Boy, sweep Duke, sweep Miami, don't get in. That would be hard.
Yeah, no question. And, you know, I think this is unusual because usually Virginia's strength of schedule is pretty good. I think this year it's not. So that's something that I'm sure they'll be paying attention to in the offseason when it comes to making up next year's schedule, to try to eliminate some of the cupcakes on that schedule. I mean, you're always going to have some, obviously, but some of these bye games, they can bite you if you're not careful. So they need to boost that strength of schedule next year because that's something that people look at too. So,
especially when you lose a couple of them, losing to Navy and losing to JMU did not help the cause. If you're going to play a bye game, you better win them. That's what's dragging the computer numbers down. And but the eyes can tell you that this is a team that, you know, again, barring a collapse down the stretch here, this is the team that should be playing in the field of 68.
Yeah, I remember Little Page used to talk about they passed the eye test, and I think that's important. There's more to basketball teams than just analytics and numbers. You got to look at them and see how they're playing and see who's good and how far they've come. So I agree with Little Page. The eye test is more important to me than the analytics.
Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock tip, go to jerryratcliffe.com and also to augustafreepress.com. We have pregame previews, breaking down all the matchups. Also, Jerry, we got to throw in ACC Network has been running its documentary series on the ACC tournament. They mentioned some things for those listening as we're wrapping up here. You might have heard the story of Ralph's House. Jerry, you've got the whole story of Ralph's House, and we've made it prominent on the front page of your website, so either mobile or desktop, so you don't have to go searching for it. But you've got the whole story there, and I think that deserves a little bit of bragging on my part on your behalf.
Well, thank you. I thought it was timely, and I actually got an email this morning from one of the guys from back in those days, Bob Sefcik, and he thanked me. He said it was nice that the ACC tournament mentioned that, but he said you told the real story, and all my guys appreciate it. So if you're a Wahoo fan, check it out. It's a great story, particularly if you knew Landon Burkhead, who I won't give away what his contribution to Ralph's House paint job was, but I think if you knew him or heard of him, you'll get a kick out of that. It was just a great story about how that whole scheme came about and how it was executed and what impact it had on Ralph Sampson when he flew over that building in a helicopter. And he didn't even want to get in the helicopter. He was scared of getting in the helicopter. So they had to do some work. If they hadn't talked him into getting in the helicopter, he might not have ever seen it. So, anyway, it's a wonderful story if you're a Virginia fan, and particularly if you're from that era, and if you didn't know the real story behind the story. So check it out. I'm not bragging, but I think you'll enjoy it.
I'm bragging. It's worth the read. And I think, Jerry, at some point, maybe off season, when we get to the part of the year when we don't have a lot of sports to talk about until football starts this summer, maybe we need to do a podcast on this, get a couple of those guys together and get everybody together to tell some tales there. So
they would love to. I think the statute of limitations has run out, so they're safe. One of my goals when I was came to Charlottesville, well, not when I came to Charlottesville, but as my career progressed in Charlottesville, one was to find out who painted Ralph's house, which we've solved that mystery. And the other was to find out who set Scott Stadium on fire for the Georgia Tech Virginia game. And I still haven't figured that one out. And if anybody knows, I think the statute of limitations has probably run out on that too. Yeah, I'd love to write that story.
We're 32 years out on it. I was a first year student. I had nothing to do with it. Okay. I was in the vicinity. My dorm was not far from the stadium, but I had nothing to do with it. So I'm innocent. But no, that would be, boy, you get that story, Jerry. And what else could we possibly want to know?
I mean, that's, and I also wanted to figure out who threw the first forward pass in UVA history, and that's in my UVA football history book. So
I've got the book around here somewhere. So I'm pointing to it right now on a shelf outside of the view of Zoom here. So maybe I need to move that behind me.
So we solved two of the three mysteries. We just need to figure out that last one.
The last one, though, that's going to be your holy grail, your Moby Dick, all that kind of stuff wrapped into one there. Well, thanks for everyone out there for listening to us. Thanks to Jerry, as always, for joining on here on the show, and I thank you for letting me be a part of the show. We will talk to you again tomorrow night, Virginia versus Duke, 7 p.m. tip-off.